Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 51, Rock on Hadron.
This Week in Law is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Business travel can kill your company's profits, so do more, save more, and travel less with GoToMeeting for your free 30-day trial. Visit GoToMeeting.com/TWiL. And by the new Carbonite Pro. It's simple, secure, and affordable online backup for your small business. For a free trial and to learn more, visit CarbonitePro.com.
Hello, and welcome back to This Week in Law with Denise Howell. This is episode 51, and we're here today with Doug Hanchard, who's a blogger at ZDNet, writes the government blog there. Doug, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you on. Doug is always sending me great links and resources, and we have good chats via email, so I wanted to get him on the show and have good chats with him here. So thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's appreciated.
Also with us is Ernie Svensson. Ernie, how are you today?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here once again. Look forward to another great show.
So were you up at, 7:30 your time this morning at your computer, busily?
No, I wasn't.
You weren't.
I know. I'm just going to wait. I'm going to wait a little bit. I'm going to exercise restraint.
Wow. I am so stunned. What we're referring to here is we're recording this on the day the iPads went on sale at 5:30 Pacific this morning. And I must admit, I was online at 6:15 ordering away. So,
you beat me.
Ernie, I did indeed. Was also enjoying email threads from our colleagues at ZDNet. Doug, did you see Jason O'Grady, who managed to pull off buying four of the things?
I did, actually. And you know, I still kind of wonder what all the hype is, because it's a reader. I mean, mind you, I'm a book fan. I don't know if you can see behind me, but I just love books. So I'm still not part of that adoption rate to the iPad yet. I haven't converted to a digital world yet in the sense of reading.
Well, you seem pretty digital to me at the moment. But before we jump into talking about the iPad and other things, I want to welcome to Evan Brown, who's on with us. Evan, great to have you back on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Wonderful. So, we actually have an iPad related story we can jump into in honor of its pre-ordering date. And that is just this lawsuit against HTC, which we talked about a bit last week over at ZDNet. Larry Dignan had a good article about how the lawsuit is chilling some other roadmaps for possibly competitive devices. And very shortly, I want to go ahead and have one of our patent colleagues come on the show and talk in a little bit more detail about the particulars of the suit, because I see a lot of confusion in the coverage about this lawsuit against HTC, about whether it actually covers the multi-touch functionality or not. But whatever it does cover and whatever's being threatened, Larry Dignan's article here has some commentary, some comments by Yair Reiner, if I'm saying that right, talking about behind-the-scenes talks where Apple is discussing with Tier 1 handset makers its displeasure at seeing the iPhone-related intellectual property infringed, and that the HTC lawsuit is just a lawyered-up exclamation point on a series of blunt conversations that have been occurring behind closed doors, which really should come as no surprise. I think what we haven't talked about yet regarding this lawsuit is its impact on the iPad and iPad-related devices and the market for the iPad. I wondered, Ernie, since you're our Apple boy, if you had any thoughts about that.
I have trouble kind of cutting through the fog to understand, you know, whether Apple could, whether they legitimately have a claim. I'm assuming that they do. But then if they do, I was kind of confused that they didn't take action sooner. And I guess Reiner's explanation that there was some negotiation going on behind the scenes seems to explain why that would have been the case. While I love Apple and I think it's great that, you know, that if they have the patents, that's great. As a consumer, though, I think it would be better if that technology was available to other people besides Apple, because that would, you know, stimulate innovation. That's my personal view. So that's basically it.
So we don't have any patent specialists on the show today, but if you guys want to weigh in at all before we go on to something else, Doug, what do you think about this HTC lawsuit?
Yeah, I actually do have a bit of commentary to it. I'm about to publish, well, I'll write a story over this weekend about the whole Apple HTC thing. Traditionally, in a patent type of suit by technology, at least lately in the last 2 years, they file two suits. So the first one is in a federal court, whatever jurisdiction they choose. And the second one is with the United States International Trade Commission, if it's international in its context. In this case, it is. And there's two real management policies that they do that for. One is to get a fast track, because typically a federal court case can take years to settle. Lots of appeals and processes and submissions. I've read the documents that were input into the USITC forum. You can go in and get them if you join up and sign into their document database system. And there's over 150 different documents that Apple has filed, most of them relating to patent. Some of them are actually redacted. And basically it goes to the point that in USITC, they can make a decision within 30 days as required by law. So there's six commissioners, six judges that review the documents and then make an initial assessment and outcome of what that's going to be. So that fast tracks the process. And then, of course, what happens is that data and information is used in federal court. I think what's happening a lot lately, I had a discussion with a couple people, one at the USITC, a Peg O'Loughlin is her name. She's the press officer for the USITC, and they're starting to see a lot more of these filings with them because it is a fast-track method of getting a case heard. A lot of this has to do with trade. The federal court will make a decision on patent infringement. They'll have to make a deal on licensing and so on, and it simply gets them on board to say, hey, it is our patent, and start paying some fees for copyright use. So I think we're overblowing a bit of the case, whether it's Apple versus HTC or in the case of Nokia filing suit with Apple. This is going to go around forever on really just trying to get some more money out of their deals. I don't think, you know, in the old days, it was Microsoft and Larry Ellison, Bill Gates, and Scott McNeely fighting in the public about, you know, who's better. And now they're just using the courts, particularly the USITC, as their mechanism. That's my kind of quick assessment of, you know, why we're seeing these suits. I don't think it's an issue of patents. I think a lot of them will be thrown out, actually. Like you say, the touchpad screen issue. That's been around in medical devices for a long time. So I'm not so sure I buy the arguments of the patents themselves. But I've had some discussions with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and they have no comments specifically that I can write about in the sense of giving official, you know, well, this is how we do our reviews, but they won't say whether the validity of that patent, you know, is earmarked to Apple or HTC or somebody else. So it'd be interesting to watch unfold, but I think it has mainly to do with trade and, quite frankly, just a licensing deal.
That's a great point you make about it being more than just patents. And Doug, I don't know if you would have seen this, but it was in the delicious links that we had for last week's show. There was a piece that Denise put up from, it's an article over on Slate. The title is called Patently Stupid, from March 4th. Farhad Manjoo wrote it. And, you know, I like the way he characterized it. I certainly don't come down on a lot of the author's conclusions about you know, how the patent system is broken, which, you know, he goes, you know, at length to essentially indict the whole patent system and say that the patents are broken, that the patent system is broken. We all know there are problems, but it's pretty extreme in it here. But one thing that I did take away from this article in Slate was characterizing this as a proxy war between Apple and Google. You know, Apple's, instead of going after Google, which is the 800-pound gorilla, you know, fighting this battle with HTC as a smaller front, less threatening front at this point. So I think it's just to circle back on what you said, it's a good way of characterizing it, more than just patents, a lot more nuanced things going on here in terms of trade and licensing as well.
Well, there's a couple issues there that, you know, I think we've seen lots of documents and articles. So the first one that comes to mind on impression, and I've seen a couple of the Twill shows that you guys have done now regarding patent and copyright, and they're kind of, you know, they're merging. I mean, the world of copyright in software, for example, like line code, is that considered authorship rather than, you know, a device or a design or an application? So but the USITC has not been used as the mechanism tool prior. I mean, if you look at the case history, there was no real high tech involved in USITC cases prior to 1990, really. They've gone up and down. I talked to the former president of the Trial Lawyers Association that handles what they call 337 cases for the USITC, and he made a couple interesting observations. The first one of which is that there is going to be significant increases of USITC 337 filings. That's just going to be the way of the world. And it all hinges on patents. And the problem is that, I mean, if you look at some of these documents, they are literally paper written in some of these cases with drawings. I mean, they're not high-tech CAD drawings they're inputting to these submissions. Some of these patents go back to 1982, which is just ideas and concepts. So, I mean, to your point, I mean, is the patent law broken? You know, I don't know if that's the issue. I don't think it's broken as so much as we need clarification as to the definition of what patent means. And I don't mean to sound facetious about it, but it's about, you know, if you have an idea that is X, Y, and Z, and it's very clear, do you have something that's public or not? Now, the USITC has an interesting segue to it. And that is, in a sense, it has, it's not classified as friend of the court, but there is an expert component for the consumer side that makes sure that the consumer impacts of a decision made by the ITC is taken into account before they make a decision. And that will weigh heavily into a federal court. Now, I'm not a lawyer, so you guys will have to kind of interpret what that means in the context of friend of the court for a decision regarding patent law and the outcomes that come out of them. But I think we're starting to see some real gray marks, that it's not that the patent and trademark office is broken as so much as that definitions will have to be clarified.
Right. And I guess in this particular instance, since we're talking about devices that definitely are not confined to any one market, your point about the ITC, the International Trade Commission, having a enhanced role in the future is an excellent one, and that maybe that's where we see these patent disputes move and get resolved.
Well, it's certainly, I mean, it's the 30-day window that they like, right? So Steve Jobs is he doesn't want to wait 10 years like he did and watched with Oracle and Microsoft battling it out in public forums, and they don't want to see another antitrust type of format of, you know, almost a decade long with Microsoft and the United States Department of Justice or Microsoft versus the European Union. Steve Jobs wants action now. So a lot of lawyers are advising him that the USITC is the method to do it.
And what Steve wants, Steve gets.
It seems so.
That's what I'm told anyway by those at Apple. Well, so we'll just have to watch that and see what unfolds. I think it is really interesting to follow along and see, you know, if the patents are about the interface primarily and how you interact with devices in the future. It's an important thing to watch, because obviously we do want there to be competition and growth. And as you pointed out, Doug, it's not like the idea of interacting with a technical device via touch is particularly a new one. You mentioned medical devices. I was thinking this morning about things like children's toys, the Leap Pad from Leapfrog, which actually is a company that was founded by a lawyer, to bring in our legal angle here. Actually, one of my dad's old law partners founded that company back in the day. And they really pioneered a lot of stuff that involved a touch type of interface for kids because it's so intuitive. So as we move more and more in that direction.
Well, you think about restaurants. Every time you go into a restaurant, you see the waitresses and the bartenders touching screens to do your drink orders or your menu orders. That's been around. I mean, I was involved with a company called Squirrel, and that was like 1988, somewhere around there, 88, 89. And Squirrel was one of the largest.
I thought Edison invented it.
Well, I mean, this is where, I mean, take your pick. I mean, touchscreen. I mean, Denise has hit it right on the nail on the head. The problem's going to be is if Steve Jobs hinges his whole fight for some money and revenues for a license deal against HTC to take a shot at Google, because I think your point's bang on. I mean, this is a big picture item, and whether iPad, iPod versus, you know, Nexus One, this is a huge deal. I mean, it's going to have repercussions. And so I think there's going to be some real fights regarding, and that's why the patent law is not broken, is so much that needs to be clarified.
Well said.
All right. Well, one thing that's been in the process of getting clarified is something else we discussed last week, and that is this school case in Pennsylvania where the children at the school were issued laptops that had built-in webcams that were being turned on by administrators at the school no fewer than 42 times to see what the kids were doing in off-campus scenarios. Doug, you had done some coverage of that. The latest on that seems to be that a couple of the district employees have been suspended or not actually
paid leave, I think, right?
Paid leave.
Yeah,
that's
they're
what
on,
I was looking
they're
for.
On paid leave.
Thank you. While they look into all of this and some of the pictures have come out. Doug, have you been continuing to follow along with this? And what's the latest here?
Yeah, it's this story just seems to have grown like wildfire in the state of Pennsylvania, and of course, in particular, Philadelphia and the lower Marion District School Board area. The high school involved is Harrington. And so each student was issued a school-supplied laptop. And the bottom line of it is that there's three prongs to the investigation. So the first one is that monitoring devices like, you know, laptops or something is not new. But, of course, you violate wiretapping laws, federal laws, if you have audio and video simultaneously recorded. Now, it looks like the FBI has investigated. They haven't come up with a finding yet. But based on the information we're getting, the audio was not enabled. Now, we don't know that for a fact yet, but if the worst of the outcome for the FBI, I think, will be investigating, I think they'll give them a slap on the wrist. The second component of the investigation is it was supposed to be, the technology was supposed to be used only for stolen laptops laptops filed as missing. Well, in this case, I mean, the student obviously hasn't had the laptop stolen. So someone was enabling the cameras on students on purpose. And now the question becomes, well, did those two administrators, IT administrators, get instructions either falsely or on purpose? And that's going to be another question. You know, who was doing the investigation on the students? And the third part of the component is that not only were the images seen, but the police department actually knew about the program. That's the latest, which is scaring the bejesus out of a few people. Mm-hmm. Because one of my articles was, well, why didn't they just call the police? Well, 2 weeks later, it turns out the police did know. the software that tracked, it's called LandServe.
LandRev, it says here.
Sorry, LandRev, that's right. I can't even remember my own article. LandRev, which is owned by a company called LoJack out of Solus Technologies out of Vancouver, BC in Canada.
Right, LoJack's the car location technology. Your car gets ripped off, you turn on the LoJack.
Right, so they license the name for computer and hardwares. They don't have anything to do with the car version of it. They only have the version for the computers and laptops and software device. So the problem there, though, is that the software was implemented and it automatically sends to the police these images. And they're supposed to be for read-only by the police. Well, that conflicts the story out of Harrington High School because what the plaintiffs in the suit are saying are that the one of the senior high school vice principals has seen these images and is accusing them, of course, of drugs when in fact it was candy. And so the proactive monitoring is really in question. And of course, that will take some time to resolve. And the newest and latest out of the story is now there are parents that are trying to defend the school board because if the suit turns out to be a class action lawsuit, it's going to break the finances of the school board. And so that's the very latest currently happening now.
You know, we got an email from a viewer, Brian O'Byrne, who wondered if we were engaging in a case of maybe not cyberspace exceptionalism, but mobile tech exceptionalism by being creeped out by this case that, you know, we'd be a bit disturbed that the district was doing what it was doing with these cameras and commented that he didn't see this as different than a security camera in a hallway. And my response back to him was, but schools don't ask you to take the security cameras from their hallways home and or plant them in your backpack without actually telling you that there's an ability to flick them on and have you be watched in locations other than the school.
The ACLU out of Philadelphia filed an amicus brief with the federal judge that's hearing the case on the Fourth Amendment, where privacy in the home is absolutely practically a religion, and it's held in high regard. So that there's a schools in New York that use the webcams to monitor, but they do it during school hours on school premises only, and then they have the policy shutting it off. And, of course, the parents knew about the laptop cameras. In this case also, the Marion School Board is saying that the parents did know, but a lot of the parents are saying, no, they did not. So there's some real confusion there too.
Yeah.
It's always good to get called out for, you know, exceptionalism like that listener does. And you know, clearly we're creeped out about this in a different way. But I would say that it's probably not a case of exceptionalism. It's just exceptionally disturbing because of the fact that it deals with mobile technology, and there's no need to belabor the distinction here between having the webcam turned on in a laptop in one's home than what there is with the security camera at school. It's very different because of that mobile aspect of it. So it is exceptional in that way, not necessarily rising to the level of this whole notion that we talk about of internet exceptionalism in almost every conversation that we have.
Right. We had several comments on this over at the show's Facebook page, which you can find at denise.howell.net/FB. We try and post things about what we're going to discuss on the show beforehand so we can get people's input. Lots of people chimed in. Mark Carlucci says it's bad enough that at my law school, we have to register the MAC address of our laptop to connect to the network. As bad as that is, school-issued spy computers would be magnitudes worse. And I tend to agree with him. You know, it's disturbing to me as a parent because laptops are supposed to be an aid to learning, an aid to helping kids integrate technology in the way that they learn and ultimately work. And to have something like this come along and make you hesitant to even have school-issued technology I think is a step in the wrong direction. Ernie, any thoughts on this before we close it out?
Yeah, I mean, I think about it in the context of being a parent, and my two daughters went to a school that was very forward thinking, and they have laptops that, of course, we pay for, but they are required to get in ninth grade. And the culture is that the students rely on the school to fix the laptops, to keep things up on the laptops and so forth. Now, I know that those laptops don't have cameras because they don't have cameras built in. But, you know, the school could install spyware if it wanted to. And probably nobody would know. And that would be really hard to detect. And, I mean, when I say spyware, I mean key logging software, you know, software that keeps track of what they're saying and chatting and this and that. And, you know, the problem is it's... you know, in one way, I feel bad for whoever's in charge of the school because, I'm going to guess or I'm hoping he didn't know about it. I don't think everybody knew about it. Somebody took it upon themselves to do this. And the problem is that people who have authority are going to abuse it. I mean, in Louisiana, there was a news story recently about a sheriff, a state investigator who was arrested because he had put a tracking device on a high school baseball coach's car as a favor to his friend. Now, why, the article doesn't say, but they found out and then they tracked this guy down. But this is going on all the time. So I can't get focused on the fact that this one Pennsylvania school did something, in isolation. This problem is happening all over the place. And I don't really know, what you can do to curtail that activity because it's easy to do and people who do it think that they won't be caught. And then if they are, of course, it's horrible. But it's just, it makes me who, a person who's not really a privacy freak and the idea of, that I feel like I need to protect my privacy all the time. It makes people like me who don't have that sentiment feel like, well, maybe I should, maybe I should be more fearful of the government. Maybe I should be paranoid. Not because, that one particular school is the most horrible thing in the world. It's just that when you have power and, people, the underlings are preparing the computers or doing whatever, and then they just decide, hey, let's flip on the switch. Why wouldn't they? I mean, it makes me feel like, what you just said, Denise, like, why would I let the schools give laptops to my kids and control it? I wouldn't want to do that.
Right. In our chat room, Web667 asked if we know if they turned on the cameras randomly or did they have probable cause first. I think that's an interesting question because probable cause alludes to something that a police or law enforcement body would have before they could obtain a warrant and do a search. And clearly there were no warrants issued here. This was something that was done at the discretion of not a law enforcement body, but the school. So I think the answer to the question is yes, it was at the discretion of the school. I don't think it was random. I think that maybe they had some thoughts about students they wanted to watch. But nobody went in and got a court order saying that yes, you can flick on a laptop camera and keep an eye on this kid. Doug, any thoughts on the procedural aspects there since you've been following this pretty closely?
Yeah, I mean, there was set procedure, protocol and process in which the documents, as I understand it, and what's been reported by the news outlets and the ACLU lawyer that assisted the court, is that the cameras were only supposed to be turned on and taking snapshots if the laptops were notified as stolen. Mm-hmm. And the two IT administrators that are now on paid leave were, and they've already been before cameras and news cameras and outlets, they've said that they got instructions from their managers to turn on the cameras and take the snapshots. Now, they themselves actually didn't look at the images. They're supposed to go to the police department. So, but this is where it gets very murky because, as you just pointed out, Denise, I mean, the cameras have been turned on 42 times. There wasn't an outcry in the past. And to Ernie's point about, the privacy issue of, just turning on the technology, the process was supposed to be only you know, it wasn't supposed to be random at all. It was supposed to be only on a process if the laptops were stolen. But there are other technologies to use rather than just a camera. I mean, it's almost ludicrous that they're even trying it. But that just basically answers your question. They were only supposed to use on any set process.
Right. Well, let's stick on the camera theme and talk about tiny cameras that are not monitoring students this time, but that are actually monitoring law enforcement folks themselves. And I'm reminded of a story that we had a few weeks ago regarding allegations and prosecution for violation of wiretapping laws by someone who flicked on, I forget if it was just the audio recorder or also the video recording aspect of their smartphone while they were watching an arrest take place because they were concerned about, oh, and here come the police now. I don't know if you can hear the sirens on the outside. Sorry about that. My secret location.
You're not recording here. Them, are you?
Yeah, exactly. I am. We all are. We're right on a fairly major intersection here, so hopefully that will fade in a moment. Anyway, this is sort of the flip side opposite of that. This is the police putting cameras voluntarily on themselves and in a to the photo from the article, which came from ABC News, which is kind of a wraparound, sort of looks like something that would hold your sunglasses on. And then in the front of it is a little camera that puts you right at the eye level of the police officer. So you see what they see. The idea is to provide both transparency into what's going on in the police activities and also provide police accountability because the officers will know that everything that they're doing is being recorded. And I assume it provides protection for them too, so that nobody can claim that someone got out of line when what you have is a recording that tells the story. Did you guys take a look at this? And Ernie, do you have any thoughts about this other end of the spectrum, police not hiding from being recorded, but adopting pretty cool looking technology to make sure that it's done?
Well, on the one hand, it sounds like a great idea, but of course, I don't think that the police are using it to be transparent. I think they're using it to stave off complaints or suggestions that they're misbehaving, and then the camera will prove that they weren't. I mean, this is kind of going, this is an extension of the cameras that sit inside the dashboard of the police vehicles, mm-hmm. except it's just more mobile. So, you know, that's great if they leave it on all the time and they don't manipulate, you know, the information later. And I think in most cases they won't. I think in most cases the police do act reasonably. The problem is when they don't, you don't tend to know about it. And so, you know, I don't think it's going to have, it's not going to be as bad as putting webcams in students' computers or having, you know, software to turn them on. But let's not kid ourselves. This is there for the police, not for the benefit of the public.
Yeah, that's a good point. Doug, any thoughts about this versus the prosecution for a passerby recording the proceedings?
I did watch your show, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, where you showed the Boston incident where a pedestrian was recording a police arrest, as I recall. And the officer asked the individual if it, you know, is that your cam, is your webcam on and that sort of thing. And because it could hold audio, it was violating Massachusetts wiretapping law, let alone federal law. I did a story a little while back ago about police officer identification and whether they should have more than just their badge number to identify a police officer during, you know, being out in public, and whether they should have their full name. And I got a lot of feedback on that. And I did a poll just as an example of what, you know, citizens think. Should a police officer have to wear a badge along with their surname? And 72% said yes, while as the other 20-odd percent said no. So when you talk about cameras defending, as Ernie's pointed out, it's for their use. I'm not so sure the technology would benefit the police in the sense of their own defense, certainly after the Rodney King disaster. I mean, everything that's highlighted now on self-incrimination is a very big issue. The other one, though, is do you take, you know, I was kind of blown away that Massachusetts even allowed that kind of law where it's okay for the police to monitor and video, but not a citizen. And that it violates a state's wiretapping law, but not a federal one. So I'm almost like if it's a double-edged sword and it's just like a 10-way street all for the police, but not for the citizen. That's kind of where my concern was.
Mm-hmm. Seems like any benefits that go to the police would trickle down to benefit the citizenry as well, because, you know, I mean, what are the police trying to protect themselves against? They're trying to protect themselves against allegations of misconduct, whether that be, you know, failing to investigate or being brutal or, you know, violating somebody's Fourth Amendment right or whatever. So because of that, because of this notion that they know that they have this mechanism to, you know, protect themselves, they'll engage in conduct that hopefully is going to be less inappropriate in the first place. And so for that reason, it seems like the question of who it really benefits kind of merges into one big analysis here. The other thing I would say about this is it seems to be a win-win for the reason that we just discussed. And it's not going to get truly scary until it's all, cameras on robots going around. I like the comparison you made, Ernie, as it being an extension of the dash board cam on the police cars. But when we can start analogizing it to the cameras that are in unmanned drones, you know, flying over Pakistan, that's when it's going to get really freaky.
So, right. Yeah, definitely.
Our RoboCop world is coming. With
well, they're already doing that in England. I mean, England has police unmanned vehicles that have cameras on board. In fact, it was told on a technicality in England that they can't use the aerial platform because it didn't have a pilot's license equivalent for aviation certification. But you can tell where the technology is going. I mean, you're going to have mobile video in the air. So that's here now. I mean, the technology and the platform is available.
And Web667 in the chat room says, cameras in police cars protect good cops from bad people and good people from bad cops, which I think is a pertinent observation. Right. So we've got lots and lots to discuss still, including our tip of the week and resource of the week and lawyers behaving badly and international DMCA equivalents. But before we get to all that, I want to talk about one of our sponsors for this week. Both of our sponsors for this week are fail-safe sort of technologies, things that you want to have in place as insurance in case something goes wrong. And the first one is Carbonite Pro. Is a service that backs up your PC or Mac, and it does it remotely, and it does it in the cloud, which I think is really, really important. It was developed for individuals, but if you're part of a small business, more than 100,000 of you have used this kind of technology to back up your computers in your offices. And now Carbonite is introducing their backup service in a new package that's optimized and priced for small businesses. It's called Carbonite Pro. You can find it at carbonitepro.com and try it free for 30 days. It's so important because not just in the event of a fire or a disaster, but there are lots of reasons why you would want to have your files backed up remotely in the cloud. Just the spilling of a cup of coffee, whether on your server or your laptop when you're traveling, could destroy your ability to access your files. So it's great to have a location where you don't need to be technical to access it. It's always going to have your backups there and accessible wherever you may be. It's easy to use. You don't need any extra hardware. You don't need to be technical at all to set it up or access your files. If there's ever a data loss problem, each employee can access their own backup files, which is really key. You can be notified and your office can be up and running again with no headaches or time lost. And it's really, really safe. The files are encrypted before they ever leave your computer, and they're transmitted using SSL, the same protocol used by financial institutions. They're offsite at sophisticated data centers. Don't need to worry about them. I think it's a great solution for small businesses because it winds up pricing out as low as $10 a month, and you just can't beat that for this kind of security. So go check it out at carbonitepro.com. Try it free for 30 days and let us know what you think. So let's do our resource of the week, which I want to go ahead and point to something we use a lot in prepping for the show. It is called MIRLN, Miscellaneous IT Related Legal News. You can find it at noconnect.com/MIRLN. It comes out about every 3 weeks or so, and it goes to members of the ABA's Cyberspace Law Committee and any other subscribers that are interested in signing up. It has just a great roundup of current things going on in the world of IT and technology law. It's curated by a gentleman named Vince Polly, who's been maintaining this list and resource since 1997. So check it out. It's a great resource if you're interested in the things that we discuss on the show. And that's our resource of the week. Evan, I think you eventually or originally pointed me toward that. Have you been a longtime subscriber?
Yes. Yeah, it's been around for a long time and always lots of good stuff there. So I'm glad you brought this up. It's one of those hallmarks.
Yeah, it's something I hadn't stumbled across before, but you know, that and some of the newsletters that come out from the law school IT and technology clinics really do a good job of rounding up the current topics of discussion and judicial scrutiny. So check out MIRLN at noconnect.com/MIRLN. All right. So let's see. We've been talking about cameras and privacy. Now I'd like to launch into, actually, I'd like to put Ernie on the spot and challenge him to find a technology angle for the Massachusetts lawyer who was suspended for using his client's handicapped parking permit that you put in our link list for this show.
Let's see. Well, you got a lawyer involved, right? So we'll go with that as the first level of being related to the show. I just thought it was, you know, it was just interesting that this person would, first of all, not only...
Well, first, tell us what happened.
Okay, so this Massachusetts lawyer gets suspended for using their client's handicapped parking permit. Now, she did this, and this is the irony factor, and this is really what caught my eye. She did this while attempting to get more than a dozen parking tickets dismissed. So she was using it, I suppose, outside the place where you deal with the parking tickets. Not only did she do that, and that was not good, but then when they asked her to provide evidence, she faked letters from her clients. And I think that's where they got her. You know, I think the first one, they probably wouldn't have suspended her just for using a handicapped parking permit. But faking letters from your clients, that's definitely going to get the attention of the ethics guys. So that did her in.
Oh, my goodness. I can't believe that someone would do that. I guess it's a good warning to folks who implicitly place their trust in the legal profession that that perhaps you shouldn't always do that.
Yeah, don't hire a lawyer who's going to ask you for your handicapped parking permit. There's the moral of the story.
Yeah, a good lesson there. What about a lawyer who works for your dad, who you have ongoing legal and other disputes with, like Lindsay Lohan?
Oh, well, yeah, the Lindsay Lohan case. That, yeah, well, that's just, What I loved about that one was the headline, "Does Lindsay Lohan Even Know She's Suing E-Trade?" And that really, it caught my eye because I was wondering, you know, the same thing as soon as they posed the question. It's like, you know, why did she watch that and think, oh my God, this baby on the E-Trade Milkaholic commercial looks like me? And then it turns out, though, that the lead lawyer, they say the lead attorney, and I assume this is the lead attorney for Lindsay Lohan and not for E-Trade, had done legal work for Michael Lohan in the past. So, you know, there's a connection. I guess you go to somebody you know. But I just, how would you conceive of suing E-Trade if you were Lindsay Lohan? Like, I mean, you'd have to have, the only way that there could be any merit to the suit is if when they created the baby, they took an image of her and then manipulated it. And, you know, it doesn't look like Lindsay Lohan to me, the baby. But, I mean, if you could at least prove that had happened, then you'd say, ah, it would be like the Obama picture, you know, where they manipulated it and you know. But, like, no, how would you even know? So
maybe
but
in then, her parent trap days.
Yeah, but I'm so conspiratorially minded for something like this. I was wondering if this is an inside deal with E-Trade. And they said, gee, who could we get to sue us who has no scruples so that we could get some attention from the press? Oh, let's call Lindsay Lohan. You know, we'll have her sue us, and then that'll, you know, extend the buzz about this ad. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me, really. It just doesn't.
Wow, that's a brilliant conspiracy theory. I think you got it.
I mean, because really, why? I mean, I just don't get it.
I'm putting on my tinfoil hat for that one.
She probably doesn't. I mean, it's true. How Lindsay Lohan doesn't know a lot of things that are happening, from what I can tell. I seriously doubt that she knows she's suing E-Trade. I think that's spot on. So then why would they sue? You know, that's my theory, and I'm going to stick to it.
She's like seeking $100 million.
Yeah. Isn't the real issue here the fact that this lawyer who's filed the complaint doesn't even show up on, like, when you search the records for the New York State, whatever the entity is that you know, regulates lawyers in New York, and then you do a search on her, and I guess I'm looking at this page from Gawker, which, by the way, the picture, if you go to the link, you know, for the article that's in the notes today, it looks like Lindsay Lohan's wearing one of those little cameras that the police use. So you don't even have to go look at. We can make fun of Lindsay Lohan without even you seeing the picture. So, but
yes, that's the Gawker article for anyone who wants to check it out.
Right. So, if there's any conspiracy here, it looks like it's a conspiracy with Lindsay Lohan's parents, right? Just hiring this kind of fly by night lawyer who may or may not even be registered to practice in the state of New York. You know, I guess it is worth going to the article because there's a screenshot from this great looking website of this law office here, this lawyer that filed the complaint. So in any event,
it looks like a GeoCity site.
and she handles traffic tickets too.
Yeah.
I wonder if she uses the handicap stickers.
And, you know, I would definitely go to, that's a good point. You know, she also does securities and mortgage fraud. I would, you know, I would definitely go. I'm not going to make fun of her. She's making fun of herself. There's no need to even say anything more about it there.
No, but you just have to wonder, somebody who handles security and mortgage fraud cases and also traffic tickets.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. There, you said it for me.
Really?
Forget $100 million name and likeness disputes. So.
Right.
You know, every time I see one of these, it always reminds me of a John Grisham novel, whether it's the ambulance chasers that Grisham describes in his novels or, you know, some shyster lawyer. And he describes so well the facetious side of law. So it's almost like this lawyer wants to get free advertising, and it's almost doing it in the same classic style of the John Grisham novel. I mean, that's how bad it is.
It really is.
Well, it plays right into your conspiracy theory, Ernie, that they would have found the ideal plaintiff lawyer to go ahead and increase her profile. So I guess we're playing right into that. All right. Well, one thing I want to do here is try and weave together a bunch of the stuff that's in our links into some kind of coherent, overarching discussion about this, about what's going on in Britain and the new copyright law they are contemplating there. What is it called? The digital Doug?
There's a couple things going on regarding copyright. There's the digital economy bill.
That's it. The digital economy bill. Thank you.
And which has nothing to do with copyright, but it's the economy, and it's the Brits doing things like the American system where you do earmarks. Well, they're doing attachments to their economy bill. So they're adding to a privacy section and any copyright capability with ISPs.
Right. And so what they're basically doing in Britain is, and again, this sort of complements what's going on internationally with ACTA, trying to build in some enforcement mechanisms that do not involve the courts, but instead involve a complaint process with ISPs that then would penalize users who are alleged to be infringing through an action by the ISP, cutting them off, or others have been urging fines, et cetera. This is something we've talked about in the context of ACTA before. So can you outline for us what these additional provisions to the digital economy bill actually seek to accomplish? Doug,
well, you want to take a crack? Okay, so there's a couple things. In the legislation for the digital economy bill, what they're asking is for the Copyright Act to have the ability for the ISPs to shut off any user that's found to be illegally downloading.
So that's where the similarity to, well, what we understand ACTA will consist of. Nobody really knows for sure.
But there is a story I'm releasing, it should be out today actually, where the European Parliament, in an overwhelming vote, I think it's like 320-23, they are not going to allow in the EU provisions for a three strikes you're out type of rule of shutting them off. But the
so that the raises the question bill, would that trump anything that Britain does unilaterally?
Very likely. The members of European Parliament, the MEPs that voted on that resolution, was, like I say, was overwhelming. And then, of course, then there's the problem of sovereignty. But Britain is a part of the ACTA treaty negotiations, which are currently going on. The next ones are going to be in New Zealand coming up in April. But Britain has decided within the digital economy bill to placate really what ACTA wants in that bill. And it also applies another section in which they're going to the extreme that they want to actually cease and desist free wireless access like Wi-Fi in pubs and libraries, because that's what they think is a source of pirating, where they, you know, you can go into a library and start downloading using their Wi-Fi connection illegal BitTorrent type of files. So it's getting to pretty extreme, this bill. That's included in it as well.
And then a third thing that's included, not just going after the ultimate infringers, the users of the network, but also going after some intermediary parties like, for example, YouTube. As I'm reading through the coverage of this act, and there's a great piece by Paul Carr over on TechCrunch, called "Hey America, Our Draconian Copyright Law Could Kick Your Draconian Copyright Law's Ass," where he does a comparison of the DMCA and this proposed digital economy bill. One of the aspects of it is that sites like in YouTube or others that don't do a good enough job of stopping illegal activity by the users could have their entire, you know, as China will block certain sites from being able to be viewed in their country, Britain is contemplating going down that road if you are cast as someone who's enabling copyright infringement. So these sites would actually be blocked and not viewable there. So a very interesting twist, and one where, you know, it's sort of, I think, putting it on the users to then bring pressure on the ISPs to crack down on third parties that otherwise have been treated as intermediaries and given a measure of protection. Evan, do you have any thoughts about all this?
The thing I find most interesting about it is the establishment of this master list of people who've been accused of infringement. That seems to be something that's new, that I hadn't heard of that concept before, a list of persistent infringers. So that's one point that I wanted to raise about this. The other one is just a commentary on Paul Carr's article over there on TechCrunch. And you know, if you read far enough down, I won't go so far as to say he defends the bill, but points out that it really isn't as bad as what some have said, particularly what, you know, Cory Doctorow, you know, in you know, the expectable Cory Doctorow style of being against any kind of framework that calls for copyright protection whatsoever in any shape or form. I think Paul Carr does a good job of enumerating some of those ways in which the bill is a bit more equitable than what it may appear at first blush. There are numbers of routes for appeal and you know, plenty of protection, this kind of due process concern that we have raised in conversations before about what to do with these who are you know, repeat infringers. So it's neat to see it going on over there.
Well, it seems like Ian Livingston, who's the head of British Telecom, has his own beef with the bill as far as its draconian nature and specifically the cutting off users aspect. And maybe that's trumped by what has just come out or been determined by the EU, Doug, as you were saying. But you did a piece on Mr. Livingston here advocating that the account cutoff portion of the bill be scrapped. What would he like to do instead?
Well, he wants to suggest that the alternative should be fines. And this is pure economics. I mean, British Telecom, and along with every other ISP, is going to lose revenue if they... I mean, I don't think it's rocket science right now that there's a lot of downloading going on. And you would lose a lot of accounts pretty quickly, whether it's legal or not, because one of the challenges to the point of about, you know, a database of downloaders. And in you guys did a piece, I think, last week on where a file was downloaded and it was marketing and it was legal, but they still sent out a DMCA notice to the guy that downloaded it saying, hey, you're illegally downloading. So the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. So there's going to be a lot of lists. And then, of course, what happens is that they're going to be cut off in the meantime. Well, you know, you lose 100,000 accounts on suspension. That's a lot of revenue. So his alternative thought was that you should be able to fine them, because to do a permanent ban, that's like saying, well, I jaywalk, should I not be able to use the roads anymore? Or if I speed six times, can I not ever drive a car again? I think there's certainly in the interviews I had with the press officer from BET, they didn't want to elaborate too much because the bill hasn't been passed into law yet, but there's lots of lobbying obviously going on. The press officer made two major comments. One was is that they still don't want to even be the holders and the gatekeepers of the information. It's a lot of technical back office. And the second one is that how do you prove it in court? So you take this master list from the MPAA or the RIAA or et cetera. How do you prove what components of the file were downloaded? And I've talked to a number of network monitoring software manufacturers and designers, and they don't hold the actual file as evidence. They only say you went from this IP address to another one, and that, yes, they downloaded from these sites. So it's up to the recording industry and the ACTA what mechanism is going to be the proof of court. And there is no, if you read the Digital Economy Bill, there is actually no set process how they're going to prosecute. It just simply says, here's what the law will state. And so lots of the details have not been worked out yet. And Livingston's concerned that they're just going to have to follow a suspension order until it's resolved. And that could take months and et cetera. And of course, meanwhile, they lose revenue.
Right. And then there's one other thing that factors in here. And another story that's in our list at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/51. And this comes from The Guardian UK about internet pirates finding bulletproof havens for illegal file sharing, bulletproof in quotes. And yep. This was a term I hadn't heard of in this context before until I read this article. But what it's discussing is the evolution of something called bulletproof hosting or website provision by companies that are impervious to legal threats and blocks. So this is how they're setting themselves aside. You know, if you are engaged in illegal activity and you're getting blocked by a country like, say, Britain or China or wherever, you can come to us and we will make sure that you get through. So it seems like just another ramping up of the game of cat and mouse, and that, you know, whether it's a three strikes law or a blocking law, that they're just never going to be able to fully accomplish what the lawmakers are seeking to, because there's always going to be some kind of loophole.
Well, I mean, if you take the MPAA's position, I mean, they're terrified for some pretty good revenue economic reasons, because like you just pointed out, it's not just the question of bulletproof, but you can encrypt, and of course you can go through proxy servers, which means that you hide your original destination and origination of your address of where you're coming from. The problem's going to be is that we're going back to the Chicago 30s. I mean, you're going to be going underground, and right now it's above ground. But there are technologies right now where people can design systems. And I talked to the president and CEO of ICANN, which is the domain name IP addressing schemes for around the world, about this. Mm-hmm. And one of the areas they're concerned about is that they're going to get court orders from countries on blocking entire address blocks. So if you have bullet.com or something else as a proxy server, you could easily see yourself being eliminated pretty quick. But if you're in Switzerland or, you know, a neutral country, are you going to block the entire country's addresses? And that's where it's going to go. That's where it's leading. That's why the MPAA and RIAA are terrified, because of the example you just gave.
Yeah. Knox Harrington in the chat room says they'll get grandmas whose grandkids got on a torrent site kicked off the internet, and the real pirates will just keep on trucking.
Yep.
And I think that's what we're seeing here. But, you know, as the cat and mouse game continues, Boing Boing had a great post on another move across the chessboard in that game, and that is that Daily Show clips or Colbert clips are being removed from Hulu. So it used to be that in an authorized way, you could go and find the great highlights from last night's Daily Show or Colbert on Hulu, but no more. And The Hollywood Reporter also asked Viacom if the network intended to go after websites or bloggers who post unauthorized clips, because, of course, you could just do a capture and post something up that wasn't authorized by Viacom. And the response was a resounding, yes, we intend to do so, said Tony Fox, PR rep. If websites are making money on our copyrighted content, then that is a problem. So Shenny Jardin over at Boing Boing writes, what a big steaming pile of epic fail. How about blogs start suing Viacom for every time a Comedy Central writer lifts an idea, a blog post, a funny turn of phrase, or a story and fails to credit, name check, or pay us? Come on, guys. You know you do it. We are the engine that propels your shows. Why do you treat us like thieves? Ernie, any thoughts on this?
It's so sad. So sad. I mean, you know, well, the quote that I like in this article is when Tony Fox, the PR rep, says, you know, yes, we're going to go after them. My feeling is if websites are making money on copyrighted content, then that is a problem. Well, I mean, most of these sites are not really making money, and they're certainly not making enough money off of the, you know, hosting the Colbert or Daily Show sites I mean, clips. What those things are doing is they're raising the level of awareness of the show. So again, I can't figure out how somebody who has this product that's gone viral can't figure out how to monetize the attention that it gets. Instead, it wants to say, no, we're not going to let the attention leak out over there because we can't figure out how to make money over there. So we're not only going to cut it off, we're going to sue the people who are doing it. They're going to sue their best customers. I mean, you know, it's insane. I mean, but it's fine. I mean, I guess that's what that's the sign of a dying industry to me. I mean, when you're doing something like suing sort of your best customers, I mean, the people who are paying the most attention that are rebroadcasting, then that just shows you've run out of ideas, you're running out of time, you're not making enough money, and, you know, pretty soon the asteroid will hit and the dinosaurs will die.
Yeah, it's doubly mystifying to me because Hulu, in my mind, is becoming indistinguishable from broadcast television. I mean, there are just as many commercials these days. They come more frequently. They don't come in, you know, four or five commercial blocks, but they interrupt the shows. And, you know, clearly they're selling ads and following the same model that broadcast television has always followed. And I don't get why, you know, someone like Viacom would decide not to just jump on that bandwagon and duplicate what they're doing elsewhere on the web. I don't really get the distinction. It's not like there's a great risk that they're being exposed to by enabling a site like Hulu to do what it does. Evan, are you a Hulu watcher? And what do you think is going to happen, not just with people pulling out of Hulu, but also with its future? Is it going to continue to be something different, or is it just going to be another TV channel?
I like how you say that it's becoming indistinguishable from broadcast television, because it is, you know, it's there, and, you know, even though it's asynchronous, and it you know, I think that a lot of people go to it as if they, in the same way that they would go to, or, you know, used to would go to a television, or would still go to a television under a different context by now.
It's just an on-demand channel.
Essentially, it is, yes, yes. And, you know, as for this article on Boing Boing, you know, I mean, I kind of see both sides of it. You know, we've got a perfect example of, you know, two views from polar opposite sides of the spectrum. Like, I think I mixed a metaphor there. Polar opposite sides of the spectrum. You know, very, very different, views on things. You got Boing Boing, and I've already referred to Cory Doctorow, and you know, we're seeing writings of his ilk here, and, you know, I'm not putting it down. That's his view. You know, just very anti-copyright, kind of at a very fundamental level. And then you've got a quote from a PR rep of big media saying, yes, we intend to sue people who are going to misappropriate our intellectual property rights. So, obviously, that somewhere in the middle here is going to be the right way. The big media, you know, probably is monetizing this stuff that they permit to be out there, and they don't even know they're monetizing it, because the more that it's out there, the more of a viral effect it has, the more people are going to learn to admire and seek out and pay for that content. But at the same time, you know, I don't want to say it too drastically, but, you know, some of the sentiment in the last paragraph of this blog post here on Boing Boing Jenny Jardin that we were talking about here is, you know, why doesn't big media pay the bloggers every time they steal an idea or lift something from a blog post? I mean, you know, kind of get over yourself a little bit. You know, it's all, you know, big media has the right to enforce its intellectual property. We have the right, as kind of more of a grassroots media, to be a little bit upset about overreaching and heavy-handed tactics, but let's just try to be reasonable about this dialogue and realize that we don't need to throw the regulatory system of intellectual property protection out the door just because of strange and sometimes one-off comments from the PR reps of big media.
Doug, do you guys get Hulu in Canada?
We do, but some of the shows, because of copyright, are blocked. I'll give you a little bit of a twist on this, if I may. The CBC, which is the largest, it's the Crown Corporation owned, federal government owned television station here, very similar to the BBC in England. We have the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. They just came out with a contract with a company out of the States called iCopyright. And it's aimed right at bloggers and other outlets for news that basically says stop using our material. And you need to have authorization and permission and pay us. And iCopyright came out with a reward that if we find you using our material without permission, and if you can rat on the people that are using it, we'll pay you up to $1 million for copyright infringement. So it's putting, there's wildfire on this news story here in Canada about the CBC. So, for example, I used to link fairly frequently to CBC reports on my blog at ZDNet. I no longer do. And to Evan's point, you lose out because you're not giving attention to the story. Or was it Ernie that said that? Sorry. You're just losing out permission to it. And so if I make a link to a story that the CBC quote unquote first reports and I don't get permission from them, I'm violating their copyright law.
They're claiming to have the ability to stop you from linking.
Yep. Linking, and you can't even use 10 words in your report, in your article, without violating what they call the terms and conditions of their content. If you go to cbc.ca/permissions, it gives you the whole general FAQ of what their content and their text article permission requirements are, their photo image, their audio, video. I did a great piece relating to a CBC production, which I'll probably pull if we ever got a notice. We don't use them anymore. We had a similar tiff at ZDNet, you may recall, Denise, with AP. Mm-hmm. And so Larry did a great piece on that one as well. But yeah, CBC has gone way off the deep end on that one. Wow. It's the same as Viacom.
Yeah, back to the early days of the internet, Evan, when cases were arguing over whether or not you could deep link.
Right. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting about your fair use law. Can you guys tell me a little more, like how would fair use apply in a case of an American website such as ZDNet or another apply to a Canadian content regarding fair use? Like, would your U.S. law trump, even though they hired an American company, iCopyright? Like, how would that play out?
I haven't defined this idea.
It would depend where you were sued, I believe. And that's generally in the location of the defendant. So
it's the CBC, which is in Canada. But if CBS, our parent company at ZDNet, had web servers in the States and I linked to a Canadian story from the CBC, would the CBC then sue in the U.S. and be underneath U.S. jurisdiction? And if it's fair use, therefore it wouldn't be applicable?
I doubt that they would sue in the U.S. because just merely linking, I think it's pretty clear down here that that's not an infringement, you know, in most circumstances. I'm not making a black letter declaration of things. And I don't even bring it into the notion of fair use because fair use is an affirmative defense to copyright infringement. And so when a defendant pleads the affirmative defense of fair use in connection with an answer, they're essentially saying, okay, we admit that all of the elements of infringement have been met, but it's okay because this use is fair, you know, balancing those numerous factors that the court will look at. And my feeling when you're just linking to content and even to a certain extent embedding content, if we look at some of the Perfect 10, the Perfect 10 cases there, let's just talk about linking to content just to keep the hypothetical simple. You're not implicating any rights of the copyright holder in the first place because, you know, if you look at what the exclusive rights of the copyright holder are, you know, it's the right to reproduce copies or or phono records or publicly display or distribute or make derivative works of. You're not implicating any of those. You're not exercising any of those rights merely by providing a hyperlink that takes the browser to some other file on the web. So I guess by convoluting it in the way that I just did by going down that path, we got away from this jurisdictional question that, that you presented. But suffice it to say, it would... Things must be really strange up there in Canada. They must be much different than they are here. If you know, the CBC is taking such an aggressive. I hope those who are just listening to the audio, you can tell that I'm smiling when I say that. I'm being a little bit sarcastic about that, but that certainly is a very aggressive position that the CBC has taken. One that I would say is not well supported in the law of the U.S. At least,
right.
Well, not to radically shift gears here, but I just had to mention that Virgil in the chat room sent me a link to let us know that the Large Hadron Collider, continues to chug on, despite the fact that Germany's highest court actually considered a case by a woman who was trying to shut it down over concerns that... it would somehow be linked to the apocalypse. So, unfortunately, she was unable to give a coherent account of how her fears would come about. And the court found that there were no dangers that she really could specify. So, the Big Bang mimicking Hadron Collider continues to do its thing.
There could be some interesting... Her case was handled by the same attorney who was handling Lindsay Lohan's case.
That's right.
Did you guys ever see that Large Hadron Collider rap video?
No.
I'll send you guys a link. It is absolutely hilarious. It's one of the best videos I've ever seen trying to explain science to someone who's interested in science and to get engaged. I'll send you guys the link. It's on YouTube. If you just... click on YouTube and then use a profile or, you know, text string Large Hadron Wrap, H-A-D-R-O-N, and then Wrap. You'll get the link to the video. It is absolutely hilarious. You'll love it. It was released about a year ago.
Wonderful. I love it when particles collide and wrap at the same time.
It's appropriate.
I can imagine, yes. I'm looking forward to checking that out.
And it might be a very useful tool to get kids who are really interested in science to also be interested in hip-hop, it sounds like.
You know what? It's the singer in that video is actually a part of the project. She's a senior researcher for them, and she has no background in music and yet pulled it off. I mean, it should be it's an all-star hit in some ways. I can't remember how many... It's a Scott. I've actually got it up here in YouTube. It's got 5.6 million hits.
Nice.
So there you go.
Awesome. Well, it's going to continue to chug on despite the
despite the lawsuit.
efforts in the judicial system to shut it down. But, you know, if we all blow up tomorrow, then we're not going to feel so cocky about all this.
Relates to the comment I was going to make about it. You wonder if there could be any interesting standing issues in there. You know, you go to a court and say, you know, judge, please enjoin this action because the world is going to end. You know, do you have the right to, do you have a vested interest in that? It reminds me of kind of like taxpayer standing questions. You know, I'm a taxpayer, so the government should stop this. Well, you know, I live on this planet, so the court should stop this. So, you know, something they could talk about, I'm sure.
Right. Well, you guys remember how Amazon got a little testy with its publishers over pricing and went ahead and yanked down certain publications because they weren't able to agree to what the pricing was. That was just a few weeks back.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They have gone ahead and gotten testy with the entire state of Colorado. And I want to tell you about that after we go ahead and thank GoToMeeting, our second fail-safe sponsor for this week. Again, this is a wonderful utility to have when what you need is to be somewhere at a certain time, interactive with one or more people, and yet travel is not an option, or it's just not convenient for you because of traffic or expense. GoToMeeting is a great way to save your time on driving and flying. You'd never get anything done if you had to fly and drive to every single time that you need to connect with your work colleagues. But that's what GoToMeeting is for. You can hold your meetings online instead. It's wonderful for sales presentations, product demos, training sessions, collaborating on documents, or just about any type of conference call. And it's brought to you by the good people at Citrix, which means that it's the easiest and most secure way to hold an online meeting. When I had my first GoToMeeting, I had it set up in just a few seconds, and you can too. And the cost after the 30-day free trial that is available to you as a viewer or listener of Twill, the cost is only $49 a month, and you can hold as many meetings as you want. So try it free for 30 days, gotomeeting.com/Twill, and save yourself the headache and expense of all that unnecessary travel or traffic. Thank you so much, GoToMeeting, for sponsoring the show. So let's see. We are going to talk about the state of Colorado and Amazon's testy action there. Nat Torkington is a guy who blogs for O'Reilly and someone I actually met in Colorado. He's a resident of Colorado. And he is, I think, one of the first people who posted this letter that went out to all of the Amazon affiliates in the state of Colorado. Apparently, the state was contemplating doing a lot more as far as policing online sales tax, and had a bill pending that I guess was actually scaled back and wasn't as onerous as Amazon even thought that it would. It requires large online retailers to start collecting taxes or to provide a summary of people's web purchases in the state. So it didn't actually require them to get the taxes, which they haven't been doing. But that didn't stop Amazon from going ahead and telling all the affiliates, I'm sorry, but if you're residing in the state of Colorado, because they are starting to make noises about having us collect internet sales taxes in your state, we are stopping our affiliates program in the state of Colorado. And then it urges the affiliates to express their views to their lawmakers there and try and get the bill altered or changed. So it's near and dear to folks who generate income off of Amazon sales in Colorado. And it seems like just another example of Amazon attempting to pass along the headache of its trade or economic dealings to the end users, here the affiliates. Doug, you write about government. Do you think that this is something that would be effective in obtaining change on a legislative level? Oops. Doug, did you hit mute?
Oh, I did. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I think there's a couple issues that are going to bring up its ugly head in the whole issue of tax and internet commerce. I think we can all remember the liquor wars of the early years after prohibition was discontinued on state law of importation of liquor between states, and how that set up distribution centers which were advantageous or were not. It's no different. I mean, the internet's going to be the same whether you import and have trade agreements between states or interstate law and commerce, or whether it's local. So if a consumer can find something that's in another state besides Colorado and it's no tax, and you import it, and are you going to create a tracking mechanism for that tax? You're basically eliminating the ability for that local associate in Colorado to collect that revenue and profitability. So there's some real, you know, in Canada, we have the same problem. In the UK and the EU, it's the same problem. It's really about revenue and the taxation capability. Right now, in the, federally at the state level or at the federal level in the US, you know, there's a very hands-off approach for taxation at all. It's just taboo. It, there's a feeling it'll handicap internet growth. But hey, we're in a recession or attempting to recover from it, and states are underneath severe revenue pressures, so they're looking at everything. I think it's more a trial test balloon of to do it or not, more than I think they'll pull the trigger. I really don't. If they do, then I think there's going to be some real harm. And Amazon, you know, coming out public the way they have, you know, they're trying to fight for the little guy. But to actually say they're going to fire their associates, I think it's probably a little strong. I think it's maybe a political tactic and a shot across the bow at legislative affairs in Colorado. If they go through with it, I think it's going to hurt them.
Evan, any rumblings in Illinois about internet sales taxes?
And not that I know of. Next? I don't follow, you know, that particular issue all that closely. But I agree with Doug. That's a political move on, it's an action on Amazon's part to trigger political movement and backlash on the part of the government of Colorado, state government of Colorado, to do that. And, you know, good for Amazon. I'm so glad that they took a stand. It's too bad that it's coming, you know, at the price of these affiliates. But I have a feeling that in the end, it's going to balance out and, you know, for the better here. Colorado's just overreaching, you know, being too grabby when it comes to that stuff. So I'm glad Amazon took a stand. And I hope that the rights of these people who are kind of having the rug pulled out from them are vindicated.
Yeah, Nat Torkington had a great metaphor in his post on this, that Amazon is playing out the female goat scenario. Amazon headbutts me, so I'll go headbutt my representative, punish Amazon's associates, and hopefully they'll pass the pain on. The illusion being that he said a farmer friend told me that the goats to keep are female goats. When one doe headbutts another, the recipient then turns to the next in the hierarchy and headbutts them. As opposed to with male goats, you get prolonged headbutt battles that are loud, intimidating, and potentially damaging. So I guess
But you know what's interesting about this whole thing, Denise, is that if Amazon going out on its own is a little dangerous from a PR point of view, because there's some huge national players out there. I'm surprised there wasn't more of a kind of a an association or alliance of retailers that came out and said this, like eBay and along with Amazon and others. Because if Colorado goes through with this, I mean, it's going to hurt them initially unless they can lobby other states that are nearby that join Colorado to go along. Otherwise, it's all going to fall apart pretty quickly for Colorado.
Yeah. I mean, here in California, we're completely broke as a state. So if Colorado is looking to increase its revenue in this way, I've got to think that other states are following suit too. Ernie, anything on the Louisiana front?
No, all's quiet down here. The Amazon soup Nazi has not threatened us.
No clicks for you. As far as Amazon goes and disclosing one's associate relationship with Amazon, you guys remember, of course, back in December when the FTC case on disclosing when you have an endorsement or payment relationship with someone and you are engaged in new media activities like blogging. This is going to be our tip of the week for folks who do engage in those kinds of activities and for the employers of those folks. We talked a lot when the FTC guidelines went into place about the kind of disclosures you should make, and we highlighted some humorous disclosures that people made thinking that that they would illustrate how sort of bizarre it is that you have to give all this information about yourself in order to put up, you know, a silly blog post about how pretty the sunset was last night, for example. But this is an interesting twist that I hadn't considered, and it is that if employees are out there blogging and podcasting and whatever else they might be doing online, and they mention their employer's products, as they might well do because they're simply enthusiastic about their job or what they're working on and what have you, there could actually be liability for the employer company. And this is something the FTC expounded upon in its comments to the guidelines that were put out last December, and actually recommended that there be disclosure of the employment relationship in that kind of setting, and also that there be some kind of internal guidelines and procedures on that for companies if they want to be protected from liability. Did you guys, what I'm linking to here is a law firm publication by a group of employment lawyers who are obviously trolling for a bit of business along these lines, but that doesn't mean that they haven't hit on something that is a valid point. And I'm wondering if this is something that, Evan, you had thought about when we originally discussed these, this sort of liability once removed, if you will, of not on the blogger's part, but somebody who might be an innocent bystander to the blogger and simply the recipient of some enthusiastic praise by one of their employees.
Yes. I mean, clearly what's implicated here is kind of this notion of respondeat superior. You know, should the statements by the employee be imputed to the employer? And with that whole framework, there is this notion of, you know, the control that the employer should place over his or her or its employees. And, you know, just kind of some commentary on this piece by this law firm. You know, firm publications like this are kind of a genre in and of themselves, and there are mm-hmm. certain ways that they should be read. And so this is a great marketing piece for this firm. But I'm going to stick by my initial feelings about all of this FTC guidelines mess. You know, I felt this way in October when the news first came out that they were going to be going into effect December 1st. And I still feel this way now. I've had some doubt about this feeling. But really, I think that a lot of the commentary on these FTC guidelines about the use of social media to endorse products is a solution without a problem, a tempest in a teapot. You know, pick your expression there. There's a lot of overkill in talking about these things. And, you know, the question of whether or not an employer should be responsible for what its employees say in connection with social media, I mean, we've got to think about that in you know, the broadest terms, even outside of the context of these new FTC guidelines. Clearly, there's a risk of liability. Clearly, it's important for employers to govern the way their employees use the web and the internet. And so that's kind of why I'm saying, you know, you've got to read these pieces from law firms in a certain way as a specific genre of writing. I don't think it's a huge issue. I don't think that it's something that a company should spend a whole lot of time fretting about. I mean, clearly they should be aware of the risk here that you know, that the employees' statements can run into some trouble here, but this is a problem that's very easy to blow out of proportion.
Yep, and just to distill this down into a coherent tip for listeners is the FTC has said that it will bring enforcement actions against companies who fail to establish or maintain appropriate internal procedures to deal with this without actually setting forth what those procedures should be. So the tip would be that somewhere in your company literature about employee online interactions should be some guidelines for how they can talk about the company's products or services and how they should disclose their relationship with the company when they do so. If you want to make sure that these FTC guidelines don't come back and bite you either directly from the FTC or in some kind of consumer protection action that could be brought over the failure to adhere with these guidelines. Ernie, any thoughts on this?
No, I agree. I think it's a great tip. You know, make sure you have a policy so that you have some highly plausible deniability or some kind of defense mechanism when your employees go off the reservation.
Yes, as they are wont to do. Speaking of employee-customer relations, I wanted to just point to something that came through on the Project VRM vendor relationship management list that I monitor and participate in from time to time. And it's something from the Get Satisfaction website. You guys know about Get Satisfaction, right? They're sort of a third-party customer service arm that allows companies to sort of farm out their customer relations, customer interactions, and customer support. And they have put forth something called the Company Customer Pact, which not only is something that I think they intend to follow themselves, but they, when you read this, it's at getsatisfaction.com/CCPact. There's a notice there called How to Use the Pact. If you represent a company, invite your customers and employees to get familiar with these values in the public spaces where you engage. As a customer, you can direct companies to the pact to encourage productive, open conversations. And it's a series of principles that are pretty simple and have some plain language definitions of how they play out in customer interactions. They're short and sweet. Number one, be human. Number two, be accessible. Number three, be authentic. Number four, be patient. And number five, be productive. And some short sentences about what those mean for you if you're a company and what they should mean for you if you're a customer as well. And I really just liked this and wanted to highlight it and think that it's a nice twist on some of the discussions we've had about terms of service and the way that companies interact with the world through them. Ernie, did you check this out and how does it strike you?
Yeah, I did. And I really liked it a lot. I think that, you know, the simple rules, the common sense rules are easy to state and easy to understand. You know, I like this list, be authentic, encourage employees to use their real names and offer a personal touch. I mean, it, you know, it is important that companies participate in, you know, with the conversation that's going on in the internet. And the companies that do it successfully are the ones who don't try to dictate and don't try to issue PR statements, but rather let employees kind of talk back and forth. And I think you see this a lot on Twitter. You know, the companies that are on Twitter and how they operate. Like, for example, I tend to follow certain companies on Twitter because I'm interested in how they operate. And you know, Southwest has some people that are Twittering, and I gather it's more than one. They seem to be flight attendants, but they're always cheerful. They, you know, it reminds you of flying on a Southwest flight if you've ever done that, because people in that culture are encouraged to do this sort of thing, to be human, you know, joke around a little bit. You know, they often have, you know, a humorous way of giving the you know, announcements about buckling your seatbelts and what to do in case of a water landing and so forth. And they do it in a funny way, and they're encouraged to do that, but that's not frivolous because it encourages people to pay attention, and it's an all around win for the company. And so I think that companies that get that are going to do better in this environment because they're going to take advantage of these tools. And the rules aren't that hard. I mean, they're very simple to state, and they're kind of common sense if you really think about it. I wish lawyers would write rules more like this.
Yeah, that's why I liked them. They were really plain language and short and sweet and seemed like, you know, obviously they carry no force of law, but if you could get people to buy into them, you might avoid disputes down the road. Evan, what do you think about this kind of a scheme?
Yeah, I like them too. And the thing I think is most innovative about an approach like this is that it gives the same instructions to both the consumer and the company, or, you know, the client and the firm, if you will. you know, the especially I like number four about being patient. Clearly, we as consumers sometimes have a hard time being patient. You can just go onto Twitter at any time and do a search on a large company's name and find people ranting about them. So it's obvious how the consumer side needs to be more patient. But that is just as well served going to the company or the enterprise or the firm approach as well. Patience with the consumer, understanding that that whole notion underlies well with the other points on this list of being accessible and being authentic. And I think it's a great calculus, a great amalgamation of concepts to put together to truly do better customer service. It is good.
Right. So the one caveat on this was that someone on the VRM list chimed back when this went around and said, yeah, but look at the terms of service of this particular site. They don't really jibe with everything that is listed in this company customer pact. Maybe someone should go through and make sure that the two are consistent. And of course, the terms of service tend to be more legalese and probably have boilerplate in them that don't actually apply to what the company's trying to accomplish, but just kind of got grandfathered in from the way that terms of service are generated and promulgated. So I think it's a step in the right direction, but you have to be careful as a company to go ahead and make sure that you not only talk the talk, but walk the walk. Doug, any thoughts on this kind of a framework?
I think it's great. There's a dynamic going on web interfaces right now that I think a lot of companies are still kind of exploring. In my day job as a consultant in ICT, probably the biggest area of imagination, and yet they want to hem in with some practical sets of rules, is on terms and service and how they convey that to customers online on their web portals. I'll give you an example where I personally went through the experience, which I thought was actually quite good. And they're still trying to improve. I was trying to on Classmates, just remove my profile. I had enough of Classmates and its use, and I wanted to remove my profile. And I used their online, person to help me remove my profile because I had some problems trying to do it. And what happened is the attendant came online, helped me remove my profile, and then sent me an email of the entire web chat that occurred, so they have a record, and so do I, that I authorized it, etc., and my profile was removed. Now, how do you make that more accessible and authentic, and the patience of it and the productivity and being human is something that companies are really challenged with right now. The last thing a computer really is human, and yet we're using it. So there's that interaction of a little chat screen. Is that enough for customer care and service? It still seems to be inhuman to a lot of the CIOs that I talk to. They wonder if that's enough and if that hurts their brand, or if that, you know, is improving their brand because it's more efficient rather than standing in a wait line or on a telephone on hold with elevator music. So there's this exploration that's going on right now, and I think these principles that they've outlined here on this site are fantastic. I think they're a good start, and now the hard part is the imagination part of transitioning that onto a web portal. So great principles, though.
Yep. Well, thanks for your thoughts on that. Do you folks remember that we had the fun lawyer letter from rocker Joe Walsh's attorney, Peter Paterno, who wrote one of the funniest yet snarkiest demand letters I've read probably in my whole history as a lawyer to political candidate Joe Walsh, who made a video as part of his campaign to the tune of Walk Away, Joe Walsh's old song from the 70s, I believe. There's actually, we were looking around when we originally talked about this letter and the exchange between the politician and the lawyer we're looking around for a copy of the video. It is on VO, and the Citizen Media Law Project has it embedded in a post of theirs that's in our show notes. So it's pretty entertaining to check out. But just following up on that story that we talked about before, it seems that the political candidate, though he originally said he was going to stick to his guns and that this was fair use, citing various examples, including parody, looks like he's gone ahead and reversed on that and is no longer going to use the song in his campaign, although it's highly entertaining. It looks like they went to some trouble to generate it because they had a band go ahead and come up with new lyrics and a pretty entertaining performance of the number. The Citizen Media Law Project outlines why it thinks this probably wouldn't qualify as a parody, and that this was pretty inevitable that candidate Walsh was going to back down. But it is pretty sad. Did you guys check this out? And do you have any different take on whether he should have stuck to his guns, Ernie?
No, I think he should not have stuck to his guns. And the article does a great job of laying out the law. And says that just because, you know, he said the candidate Walsh said it was a parody and that was protected. And apparently that's not necessarily the case because, you know, you just because you invoke something that was done by somebody else in a seemingly humorous way, that doesn't mean it qualifies as parody. You know, the leading case, which is referenced in the article, is the Dr. Seuss case. And they talked about, you know, somebody who's making a point about an author is making a point about the O.J. Simpson trial, you know, wrote that the cat is all caps, not in the hat, a parody by Dr. Juice. And they said that didn't qualify as a parody. And it seems to me clear. I mean, my instinct was it didn't make sense because the candidate wasn't using the song. I mean, he was using it to benefit him and to benefit his campaign, which would be the same as the company using it for profit, which would not qualify as fair use.
Right. And there's the added component here that the guy's name is actually Joe Walsh. So right. Above and beyond just the use of the tune, there's the chance of confusion that the rocker is actually endorsing the campaign, which he apparently did not want to do.
Yeah. I mean, this case is basically a law review exam, you know, preformed.
Mm-hmm. Yep. With musical accompaniment. Evan, any thoughts on this?
Fair use is always so tough. You know, it's so wishy-washy. These factors, you know, incidentally, they're non-exhaustive factors. I think that the analysis here that we've talked about on this factor of the nature and the use of the work in showing that it's not a parody and therefore it's non-transformative. I mean, I think that's probably correct. But we've also got to keep in mind these other things like the effect on the market of the work the effect on the market for the original work. There's an argument to be made here that the use of this work in this context, which is different than when I think of, you know, rock from the 70s, I think of arena rock with people holding up, you know, the lighters and stuff during the anthem and all that stuff. But, you know, the use of this work could, you know, essentially spur a renaissance of interest in Joe Walsh. So could it be said that the effect of the market for the original work would actually be enhanced? And it could, this is tying back to what we were talking about earlier with Comedy Central and its decision to take stuff off of Hulu and to cut down reuse of it by bloggers and others. There's a much more sophisticated analysis that goes on here just than that one examination of that one fair use element, the nature and the character of the use.
Yep, absolutely. Doug, any thoughts on rocker Joe Walsh versus politician Joe Walsh from your government perspective?
Only that when I watched your show about it, I practically fell off my chair. It was a great segment that you guys did. I didn't know existed until I saw it on your show. So one thing that it just makes a bit of an impression on me, though, about that whole episode is, I mean, you have a very big California Senate election coming up. and the amount of comments on quoting people, for example, which I think is the same thing as copyright. When you make a speech, that's in a sense content. And if you take snippets of it, or if you take a parody of it, is that a basis for a lawsuit? So it's going to be interesting, particularly as we go forward. I understand what you guys have stated as per the law. I mean, it makes sense. And it's just going to be very interesting. Already we're seeing wildfire between Carly for Arena and Campbell and DeVore on what their speeches are, or their Carly's white paper or master's paper has been taken to task. And if you take it out of context, is that a right to sue because you're just taking a snippet of the body of the work for your campaign or something? So is it any different? And this is where, again, fair use and is it going to enhance their work or et cetera becomes a landmine of, this is where you guys as lawyers can make a living, because it's beyond me as to how far you can take this and to, you know, where it ends.
Well, political speech is generally outside the creative realm of copyright law, that's been carved out as a matter of policy, at least in the United States.
Okay, but if you take the example of if Carly's speech at HP, which is a matter of record for the company, and then another person takes it and wants to use it in their political campaign, are they violating HP's copyright?
I see what you're saying. So not something done in the context of the campaign, but something done before.
Right.
No, that's a different question. And I think you are raising valid concerns there. And you're actually reminding me that I wanted to stick a link in for this week that I didn't get around to putting in the show notes. And I don't exactly remember the name of the site, but I do remember reading about it and remarking that it was interesting. And it is a wiki oriented crowdsourced information gathering site that deals particularly with Carly Fiorina. And maybe someone in the chat room remembers what it's called. I'll dig it up and stick it in the show notes. But the idea is to take sort of the muckraking role, if you will, and put it out to the public and have people go ahead and contribute whatever it is they know about this particular candidate. And I assume that we'll see them springing up for other candidates as well, so that their past transgressions and writings and everything else has sort of a centralized place where it can come out from any number of sources. I thought that was a real interesting development. You know, I mean, we saw over the last couple of presidential campaigns, we've seen some real interesting uses of the web for fundraising and gathering information. And this is the first instance I've seen of, you know, asking the public at large to contribute their tidbits of information about a particular candidate. So I'll go ahead and track that down. And
there was one posted on Twitter, anti Carly for Arena, and they've got a website that's all about the mistakes of Carly for Arena.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting to use the Wikipedia kind of model with self-policing and ability to correct inaccurate or spurious information and let the more credible stuff, relatively speaking, remain. So we'll have to see how that all plays out and if that becomes the norm in our political process. And for that, I think we'll go ahead and round out the show. I want to say a special thank you to Colette Vogel, and let folks know that, as you know, Colette joined Microsoft as one of their in-house counsel earlier this year. And we've talked about it on the show before. And I-A-N-A-J, I am not a journalist, but I don't even pretend to play one in this context. But other folks who are and who we've been talking to within TWIT have decided that it's better for all concerned for Colette to be a more tangential member of our family than the regular role she's been playing on the show. And I do hope to have her back on a less regular, more semi-irregular basis as a guest on the show. But because of her role at Microsoft, we did not want to continue to put her in a situation of having to decide what issues to chime in on or not chime in on, and when she would have to bow out or disclose or change hats or what have you. But we love Colette, and we're dearly going to miss having her regularly appear on the show. And a personal note of thanks for all her contributions. And I really look forward to continue connecting with her. And I hope that all of you will as well. And even though she's not joining us this week, do continue to follow along with her on Twitter. She's at Vogel Law. And you can find her at vogellaw.com on the web. And we wish her all the best, as I also wish the best to all of you who participated in this week's show. Doug, it's great to have you on, and hope to do so again sometime in the future.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. You can read my blog at government.zdnet.com, and be more than glad to come back anytime you want.
Sure. And you're at DHanchard, and I always find great stuff in your Twitter stream. So I encourage people to check that out. Evan, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. Another great time. Doug, it was nice to meet you. Enjoyed our conversation.
I wanted to ask you, likewise. Evan, I saw you tweeting at Internet Cases, and folks can find you at internetcases.com on the web as well. Saw you tweeting about the Men at Work case and the Kookaburra flute riff. Are you going to be posting about that on your blog?
Well, it's a long decision, so I don't know if I'm actually going to read a 60-some page decision from an Australian court. But in the early part of February, the federal court in Australia found that as you said just there, the flute riff for the Men at Work's Down Under, and you'll recognize it when you hear it. I'm certainly not going to disgrace myself by trying to imitate it on this conversation, but those few notes there are a copy of the children's campfire song, "The Kookaburra Sits in the Old Gum Tree." And so for those of us who have children, those are both familiar tunes, and I was astonished when I heard them. It's like, oh my gosh, those are the same things. And so yes, the court came down in favor of the owner now of the copyright in that children's campfire song. So very thanks for noticing that. That was a quirky little decision from Down Under.
Yeah, fascinating that someone could own the copyright in that. It's like the craziness that somebody owns the copyright in Happy Birthday to You.
Yes. It was written back in the 1930s, and the original composer, is long gone, but now the copyright's in the, actually owned by a large corporation. So it wasn't necessarily the little guy versus the big conglomerate. It was two large multinational corporations going against one another in court over this.
Right. I skipped ahead to the end of the long decision when you brought it to my attention. It looked like they found an infringement and they're going to have to wind up paying some substantial royalties over it.
Looks that way.
So anyway, thanks for bringing that and all kinds of other internet and non-internet but interesting legal related things to our attention on your blog, internetcases.com.
Thank you.
And Ernie, thanks so much for joining us once again.
It's great to be here, and I just wanted to give a shout-out and let everybody know that I'll be at the ABA Tech Show March 25th through 27th. So if anybody's going to Chicago, other than Evan, who's already there, I'd love to meet up with you if you're going to be at the ABA Tech Show.
Wonderful. And in the meantime, if you can't join Ernie in Chicago, you can follow along with him. Hopefully, you'll tweet out anything interesting that happens from the venue, Ernie.
Absolutely.
At Ernie Attorney on Twitter, and ErnieTheAttorney.net is Ernie's blog. Folks, you can connect with me outside the context of the show. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Love to hear from you about ideas for the show and anything else that's on your mind. Also, you can follow me on Twitter as I get ready each week. I go ahead and link the Delicious account to my Twitter account. So as I'm saving things that we're going to talk about the next one, they pop up in my Twitter stream at D Howell. And we really appreciate your sticking with us and listening to 1251. We'll see you next week.